Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Lucy Suchek. Today, we take you to the World Affairs Council at the Cumberland Club in Portland for a talk by the Chief Trade Negotiator and Deputy Ambassador for Canada, Kirsten Hillman. The title of today's talk is Canada and Maine, Shared Past, Bright Future. This talk kicks off the World Affairs Council's year-long focus on the relationship between Canada and Maine. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and this program will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to hear the program again at your convenience and to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is David Allward, Canada's Consul General to New England.
I feel at home in many ways tonight. I guess along one border in Maine. How many know where Holton is? Okay, very good. So if you stay on I-95 as far north as you can, and you manage to avoid all the moose, okay, you get to 15 minutes on the other side of the border. There's a community called Woodstock, and I live in the suburbs of Woodstock in a place of about maybe 65 people. Called Riceville, New Brunswick. So that's my home. But my part of New Brunswick is very much connected to the great state of Maine. And I am certainly very honored and proud to be able to serve as Canada's Consul General here. A lot of the work that we do, when I do my Twitter work, social media stuff, I sign off as friends, partners, and allies. And that is no more relevant or evident with the relationship between Canada and Maine. And you can add family into that as well. We've had a great couple of days with Ambassador Hillman in Portland and in Augusta. Lots of meetings and on NPR, all sorts of cool things. I am so pleased to be able to welcome tonight Ambassador Hillman here. She's an incredibly accomplished woman. Before she became Canada's Deputy Ambassador in Washington, she was Canada's Chief Trade Negotiator. So who's heard of TPP and things like CETA, okay? NAFTA now. She led Canada's negotiations in those progressive trade agreements. So we're very pleased to have her in Washington as part of our U.S. network now. But in speaking to Kirsten last night, I knew she was from Manitoba and Alberta is where she grew up. What I didn't know that her family also has grown up along the border with North Dakota. So that's the reality of connections along the way. So. Ambassador Hillman, we're really looking forward to your comments tonight. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, David, and thank you to everyone who's here tonight. It's a true delight to be here. Before I get into my remarks, I want to tell you a bit of an anecdote. In the year 1866, on a dark and stormy night, a hurricane pushed a Canadian steamship called the SS Queen Victoria to its inevitable doom off of Cape Hatteras, North Carolina. When all seemed lost, out of the storm, a brig from Maine came to the rescue and saved all but two on board. The Queen Victoria's captain took with him only a few items, including the ship's magnificent 90-pound bell. In gratitude, he gave the bell to the Maine ship's captain, who in turn gave it to his hometown of Prospect Harbor, which is now Goldsboro, as I understand. So to this day, that bell resides in Goldsboro. But the Queen Victoria was no ordinary vessel. 2 years earlier, in the summer of 1864, She sat anchored off of Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island, serving as a kind of floating hotel conference center for some very, very important talks. There, representatives from the separate colonies of Ontario and Quebec, New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, and Prince Edward Island hammered out the first elements of an agreement that came together as a confederation of those colonies into a single independent country. 3 years later, in 1867, due to those talks, Canada was born. So in Canada, we call the men that were aboard the Queen Victoria that night, or those during those days, the fathers of Confederation. Now, we all know how difficult political discussions can be, and in particular, constitutional discussions. So as legend has it, and records show, that those in charge also knew that well, and therefore they ordered numerous cases of champagne to be loaded aboard the SS Victoria. Again, according to actual historical documents, the delegates did not neglect these beverages. So, in America, your country came together and was born out of a revolution. Our country was born out of some conversations on a boat with a whole lot of champagne. In 2017, for Canada's 150th anniversary, which was a really large celebration of joy for our country, Goldsborough generously donated the bell to the Canadian Museum of History in Ottawa for an exhibition. And it was labeled at the museum as the Confederation Bell. Thousands and thousands of Canadians were able to walk past it and learn this particular history that brings Maine and Canada very close together. So what better way to start my talk, and what better way to celebrate the friendship between our country and Maine? So before I start, I would like to say thank you very much to the World Fairs Council for inviting me. Thank you, Kate. I'd also like to recognize Brenda Garrett, who made some remarks. She has been a delight to get to know over the last few days. A bit exhausting, very effusive, and very effective. So you're very lucky to have her, and we are doubly lucky to have her as Canada's representative here in Maine, and I thank you for everything you've done to make this trip such a success. So, as David said, I've been here for a couple of days. I've spent quite a bit of time with Mainers, and something in particular, something really delightful has happened. I think that there has not been one single conversation that I've had, whether it's with state legislators, federal legislators, the governor and her office, some businesses and business representatives we met at a reception. There hasn't been one single conversation that I have participated in where somebody hasn't said, I have Canadian ties. My parents, my mother was Canadian, my parents were Canadian, my son's married to a Canadian, my uncle was from Canada. I go fishing up in Canada every year. It's been remarkable. It's been heartwarming. It's been delightful. I spend most of my time inside the DC Beltway, and it is an honor to serve my country there. It is a slightly less warm atmosphere than the one I've been enjoying over the past couple of days. Not climatically, it's much warmer. But interpersonally, it's quite delightful and lovely and refreshing, and I'll probably be back next week. So, we share history, we share geography. For generations, our citizens on both sides of the border have worked together. They've worked together in the forestry sector. They've worked together on our oceans, harvesting the bounty of the oceans in dangerous, difficult jobs. I am thinking about how to talk to you tonight. I wanted to try and cluster my comments around some themes that I think are very relevant to our relationship. And those themes have only become more clearly relevant based on my time here over the past couple of days. We are united by history. We are rooted in a common geography. There is, between Canada and the United States, 5,000 miles of what we call, we used to call undefended border. I think the right way to put that is non-militarized, safe border. We share ocean boundaries. We share lake borders. As you know well, Maine shares two borders with Canada and only one with another state, which is also delightful. But this geography, I think, is important because it brings us together not only as families that have been crossing the border and marrying each other and fishing together for years, but also because it makes us jointly responsible for our security, for ensuring the way in which people come into our communities is appropriate and safe. It also gives us a joint responsibility to be proper shepherds of our environment, because we share our resources, we share our air, we share our land, we share what is going on in the world today in terms of how those things are changing. And of course, and probably closest to my personal experience and heart, we have a fantastic opportunity to have a strong, vibrant, mutually supportive economic relationship. Yes, between Canada and the United States, and I'll talk about that a little bit, but between Canada and Maine, it is the single most important relationship between the state and the provinces that border this state. So all of these themes are what I'd like to sort of order my thoughts around tonight. And I'm going to start, again, because it's more my comfort zone, with Canada-Maine trade. So, our relationship, our trade and economic relationship, is based on the fact that we live side by side. It's based on the fact that we share geography, culture, values, and it has been that way for centuries, and today's no different. So, Canada is Maine's number one export destination, and in fact, Maine exports more to Canada than you export to your 18 next export destinations combined. In 2017, bilateral trade in goods rose to the $3 billion. And these are impressive figures, and I always like citing big, impressive figures, but I think what's most important is for people to be able to identify what that means within their communities and their neighborhoods and their towns and their cities and amongst people who need to have and want to have economic opportunities and prosperity. So, what does that mean in your communities and neighborhoods? It means that companies like Sun Life here in Portland, Canadian company, providing economic opportunity and jobs. Irving Oil across the state. J.D. Irving Forest Products, as folks will know. Cook Agriculture, TD Bank, of course, McCain Foods. I mean, I could go on, I won't go on, and hopefully there are no other Canadian companies in the room who I've forgotten. But very important, significant investments here in the state providing jobs and providing opportunities. There's one story that that David, our Consul General, was describing to me that I want to highlight because I think it's really quite wonderful. I might not pronounce this quite right, but Mastronati Products Limited, which is a Canadian company that specializes in year-round tomato growing, for obvious reasons, given our climate, your climate, it owns backyard farms in Madison. And it is New England's largest tomato grower. It produces 25 to 30 million pounds of non-GMO tomatoes every year and is Madison's largest employer. I think that's fantastic, right? And I think that it's fantastic that they do it here from Maine. They could do it across the border, but they're doing it here. And why not? For all the reasons that we know that tie us together in all sorts of ways, I think that seeing this region as one community can do nothing but help everybody. There are also, sort of along that philosophy, many Maine companies that do business in Canada. So, for example, Wexfleet Payment Systems, headquartered in Portland, Stonewall Kitchen in York, a thriving company that for 100 years has straddled the borders is Twin Rivers Paper Processes. So it treats lumber and pulp, and some people are nodding their heads. This is a great story, too, which I didn't know until coming here, which is fantastic. And in fact, the governor said she had just visited, which is amazing. So this particular company it treats the lumber and pulp in Edmundston, New Brunswick, and it pipes it across the St. John River and produces specialty paper products at the mill, which is in Madawaska, which is fantastic, right? I mean, what greater story is there than that? So those are examples that are regional examples of a larger, incredibly successful, single most important bilateral trading relationship in the world is the Canada-US trading relationship, single biggest bilateral trading relationship in the world. There are over 9 million US jobs that depend on trade with Canada, and we have, so the figure of, you know, your best customer of Maine, where the, as I said, you sell more to us than to your next 18 trading markets combined. If you look at that at a national level, Canada buys more from the United States than we buy from China, Japan, and the UK combined. Our bilateral goods and services trade rises to $2 billion a day. $2 billion every single day. So there is nothing more important to both of our economies than making sure that we have a stable, solid, predictable, mutually reinforcing, innovative, competitive trading relationship. But we do a lot more than just sell stuff back and forth, right? This is the modern era. And as we all know, in the modern era, what happens is that products move back and forth across borders. And they get transformed here and move there and transformed here and move there. And such is the case between our two countries. Whether it's the agriculture sector, where you have calves born in Canada, fed in the US, moved back to Canada for slaughter, meats moved back to the United States for processing. This happens regularly across our prairies and central Canada every day. Likewise in manufacturing, right? One statistic that we have talked about an awful lot in recent months is that before any vehicle is actually running, you know, coming off the assembly line as a finished vehicle, chances are that the parts in that vehicle have crossed the Canada-US border up to 17 times. Again, we can talk about the USMCA now and after later if you like. But these are really important real-world facts, right? And there are businesses, and we're not talking about, you know, the big Detroit Three, although we are talking about that, but we're also talking about the little tool and die maker, or the person who makes the foam for the seats for the you know, minivan, or the people who do the IT services for the guy who makes the foam seats in the minivan. This is an incredibly interconnected network of individuals and companies. The vast majority of them are small and medium-sized enterprises with fewer than 50 employees that rely on a stable, solid, predictable trading relationship between our two countries. And so what I would say to you is that there is nothing more important than not only safeguarding it, but ensuring that it stays current and responsive and is doing what we need it to do for our businesses and our companies. So this brings me to the USMCA. And we can talk a lot about this if you want in the question and answers. But there are a lot of topics I'd like to cover, so I will speak in general terms about where we're at on that agreement. The Canada, United States, and Mexico have concluded the renegotiation of the NAFTA. We did that in the fall. Before I go into some of the features of that, which I think are worth underlining, I'd like to just take a step back. So as David had said, I've spent the vast majority of my career as a trade negotiator, trade lawyer and trade negotiator. And I think it's really useful to put into perspective why it is that governments enter into trade negotiations and what that policy tool is for. So if you want to boil it down to its most simple terms, a trade agreement between nations is essentially designed to do two things. It's designed to open up markets, as between the two countries, to grant oftentimes privileges to the country you're negotiating that you're not granting to other countries. So, you know, the most obvious is tariff-free access. But there's also other ways, regulatory cooperation, there's opening up your services market to that other country, protecting intellectual property in very specific ways with that other country. So you agree to certain kinds of concessions, if you want to call them that, certain kinds of actions you're going to take at a national level in order to open your market to the other country. And you do that for a couple of reasons. One, most obvious, is to incentivize exactly what I've been talking about, which is the integration of economies, the opportunity for businesses in the two countries to want to do business with each other, and perhaps want to do business with each other more than they want to do business with another country with whom they don't have this open and privileged relationship. So it is a conscious policy decision by a country to say, I think we have an opportunity here to make our businesses stronger, better, more competitive, find new markets, find new customers by partnering with this other country and integrating our economies, or at least trying to, because governments can't make the decisions, those are private sector decisions, but creating conditions to incentivize those kinds of relationships. That's the first thing. And that's what people mostly focus on. But the second thing that trade agreements do, which I think has become very clear in the past year and a half in discussions between our two nations, is that they set a stable environment, right? So national governments will change, and with that, regulations may change, and ways of doing business may change based on political imperatives in different countries. But trade agreements, international agreements generally, and trade agreements specifically, are designed to supersede those changes. You lock yourself into certain kinds of commitments that are meant to be there for the long term. And now that's a hard thing for governments to do, and sometimes people will say, well, are we giving up our sovereignty? And the answer is kind of you are, yes. You're voluntarily giving it up, so I don't know if that's a very sovereign decision to actually bind yourself, right? But you're doing it because you are trying to create a long-term stable environment so that companies will invest. And if you're going to build a plant in a foreign country, you want to know that you have some sense of what the rules of the road are going to be in the long term before you make those investments. And the proof of that is that over the last year and a half, and I was saying to someone, I was explaining this to someone or talking to somebody about this before coming in here tonight, over the last year and a half, we've had many Canadian companies come to see us in Washington and try to understand, before the USMCA was concluded, and try to understand where negotiations were at. And the reason people were so very focused on it, and big Canadian investors were so very focused on it, was because they were not investing, and they were not expanding in the US. They were nervous. They didn't know what was going to happen. They felt that there had been a very stable relationship for the past, well, since the Canada-US FTA, so 30 years, all of a sudden there was volatility. And they had made multi-generational investments, and they were looking to make more or expansions, but they weren't prepared to do it until things settled down. And they're not going to publicize that. That's not something they're going to go and tell people about, but that is what happened. Now, thankfully, what has happened since the fall is a lot of those companies have come to us and said, okay, we're starting to sort of, you know, open up and dust off the plans that we had, and we're looking at it, and we're going back down to this state or that state, and we're looking at the investments that we might like to make because we feel that we have a state of stability. But that is fundamentally, and I would say most importantly, what international trade agreements are for. It's to create an environment of stability. It's nice to open up markets, but businesses, they're going to adapt. They're going to adapt to the openness or closeness or regulatory environment. But they will make decisions that will disincentive, that will lessen investment if they feel that they can't take the risk. So that's my trade agreement 101 little spiel. But those are the core objectives, right? And those are the core objectives between the Canada-US FTA, the NAFTA, the WTO agreements, and every other agreement that both of our nations have entered into. Now, it is also true that the NAFTA was old, right? It was written in a time that was very different economically and globally than we are in now, with the rise of certain countries, China most obviously, but India and other developing countries, on the world stage as economic players, with the creation of global value chains, as I've described, with the expansion of international intellectual property values, with the expansion of international trade and services. All of these things have made that agreement somewhat dated and somewhat unresponsive to the realities of current business. So the other thing that most certainly has happened since the NAFTA was concluded is that there are communities, both here in the United States and in Canada and elsewhere in the world, who, because of these changes in the economy, and possibly also because of rules set out in trade agreements, very much felt that the promise of international trade and globalization really just hadn't materialized for them and their communities. And there's been a lot of discussion around that, right? There's been a lot of discussion around how certain sectors of your economy and our economy have not been helped by the displacements and changes that have happened in the global economy. And that, I think, will be even more, I don't think we're going to see that less. I think we're going to see that only more and more as time goes on, because with mechanization and artificial intelligence and all of the technologies that are just really ramping up at such a huge speed, I think that is going to be a challenge for all of us going forward.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's talk features Ambassador Kirsten Hillman discussing the relationship between Canada and Maine.
So, our government, and certainly under the Prime Minister Trudeau's leadership, wanted to go into this negotiation, and not only the NAFTA negotiation, but our negotiation with Europe and our negotiation with the Pacific countries and the TPP, by saying, okay, how can we respond to that? Is there something that we can do about that that will make these agreements more respectful of and responsive to the concerns that are being raised? So that was a core element of our approach in the NAFTA negotiations, and has been a core element of our approach in other discussions as well. So I'm going to give you some highlights around what that means in practice. The accomplishment of the renegotiated NAFTA is that we maintained the same level of duty-free access as between our two countries, which isn't a small feat, because it was the most open relationship it is the most open trading relationship that we have. So we have 98% of the goods going back and forth between Canada and the United States are 100% duty-free, except for steel and aluminum. We'll talk about that later. Second, we made updates to the agreement to make trade more accessible. In particular, we were focusing on small and medium-sized enterprises for the reasons I was describing, but also focusing on minority-owned businesses, trying to offer, for Canada, very important, some provisions around Aboriginal-owned businesses, women, and ensuring that there was a provisions in the agreement that didn't allow for discrimination in the field of labor and employment for women, and that opened up chapters to reducing red tape and harmonizing, if we can, ways in which we approach certain kinds of regulatory and administrative issues. We also preserved dispute settlement, which was very important for us, to make sure that the rules that we are putting in place are subject to arbitration by independent bodies. We also updated and modernize the labor and the environment provisions and made them standalone chapters within the treaty that are fully enforceable. And the labor provisions are very important because they are really a step well, both labor and environment are the most ambitious chapters in those two areas that I have seen and that we have ever entered into. And labor in particular sets a minimum standard for wages and sets some very clear rules on the right to unionize, for example, and wage disparities between people. So this was primarily targeted, as you can imagine, not to us, but to the third negotiating partner in the NAFTA, and I think was something that was a really core priority of the administration, but I think is good for our region, the NAFTA region. We can go on around the content of the agreement if you like, but I think that ultimately what I would just say is that it is now a truly modern agreement. We have a digital trade chapter, we have a new trade chapter on combating corruption, we have a new chapter that is dealing with accountability of our public officials. There's a digital trade chapter, there's a good regulatory practices chapter, which is all about transparency, so citizens know what the regulations are going to be. So there's lots and lots of good stuff in there. And I think that it's an important agreement, that it's important that it's been modernized, and it's important that it's now putting us back into a more stable position. However, we are not quite there yet. And the reason we're not quite there yet is that before we are going to be able to move forward to really bring this agreement into force, we're going to need to have the U.S. administration remove the tariffs on steel and aluminum that were placed on our country and on Mexico, and they were placed on other countries as well, a little over a year ago. These tariffs cover over $2 billion of Canadian exports to the United States, and in countermeasure, if you will, we have imposed dollar-for-dollar tariffs on the U.S., which is ridiculous, right? Both ways. It is ridiculous. It's ridiculous, and I'm not saying my government's ridiculous. I think my government absolutely had to do that. They had no choice, right? They have to say you can't, they have to meet these actions with commensurate counteractions. However, those come out, just to put it in context, for Maine, $67 million worth of Maine exports to Canada that were duty-free that are now subject to tariffs between 10 and 25% because of this TIF that we are having. And that's just Maine, right? As I said, it's dollar for dollar. So it is not the way friends, neighbors, and business partners should be behaving. And furthermore, the justification for it of putting the tariffs in place, which was deeming Canadian imports into the U.S. of steel and aluminum posing a national security threat to the United States, is something that is really hard for Canadians to understand, right? And we can talk about that. I'm going to talk about our defense relationship a little later so I can elaborate. But there are many reasons why that's very hard to understand. So the president's also said, you know, those tariffs are in place while the negotiations are ongoing. Once they're done, we'll remove the tariffs. The negotiations are done, and the tariffs must come off. And our government could not feel more strongly about that than we do. But, you know, it's not just us. There's also a lot of research that's showing that they're very, very harmful to the U.S. economy. A group called Trade Partnerships projects that over 400,000 net U.S. jobs have been lost since the imposition of these tariffs, and that the increase in U.S. GDP from the USMCA, which is up in the hundreds of millions, is completely abrogated by the $1.8 billion worth of countermeasures that have been imposed as between Canada and Mexico on the United States. So it's really, we found ourselves in a bit of a situation that really we need to all move away from. Sorry. I didn't mean to end the trade talk on such a bad note, but I do want to be really, really very, very clear about it. We've made some really important progress under very difficult conditions over the past year and a half, and we've achieved some excellent outcomes. And I think that we have a modern, progressive new NAFTA that we can all be very proud of, our government is proud of, but it will not come into force until those tariffs are gone, and they have to go. So whatever power you have over the White House, please use it now. So I'm going to change topics. I'm going to talk about another area of cooperation between Maine and Canada that I think is very, very important, and that is fighting climate change. Sadly, you know, earlier this year, NASA and the NOAA released some figures that showed that in the last 5 years are the warmest that have ever been recorded on our planet. There are grave and serious consequences that are coming from that. And as we all know, you're feeling it here as much as anywhere with the Gulf of Maine, the temperature in the Gulf of Maine rising faster than almost any other part of the ocean. Real consequences to our environment, real consequences to our habitat and our fisheries, your habitat and your fisheries, and we must do something about it. From our perspective, Canada has a fairly robust and multifaceted action plan that's in place. We are putting a price on carbon. We are phasing out coal. We're making historic investments in public transit, enacting targeted regulations to reduce emissions, and putting in place measures to incentivize green infrastructure. So this action plan, which we can talk about a little bit more, is making a difference. Our emissions are dropping. We're working hard to meet our Paris commitments for 2030. We're on track, but it's actually going to require concerted effort because you know, things change, but the government has been very, very committed in that respect. We're working with the United Kingdom on an initiative called Powering Past Coal, which is designed to eliminate coal in the electricity generation sector. There are some New England states that have been interested in joining this initiative and may well do so. And hopefully, you know, Maine will be one of those in the future. There's no silver bullet. This is going to be a generation or multi-generational initiative, but I think in hearkening back to my opening comments, in a community where we are so very tied geographically, where we have so much going on back and forth, it is the perfect place on this planet for us to try and come up with solutions together. And one of the interesting initiatives that we talked to the governor about this morning was the biggest and I think longest corridor for electric charging stations for electric vehicles is being created between Quebec City and here, right, in Portland. So it may seem like a small thing, but these are really important moves that are being made, and we really do feel very positive about that. I think there's lots to say about the environment, but I realize I'm probably talking too long, so I'll try and just mention one thing. The New England Clean Energy Connect transmission project has been something that has come up in a lot of the discussions that we've had over the last couple of days. I'm very convinced that this is a very good example of regional cooperation to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The project is going to bring 1,200 megawatts of clean, reliable, affordable, hydro-powered energy from Quebec to Massachusetts. It's going to permit Massachusetts, which is the largest emitter in New England, to make further progress towards clean energy. And Quebec Hydro, which has been supplying energy to the U.S. since the 80s, is going to provide hydropower with a transmission project built by Central Maine Power, which you may know the details of this better than I do. But I think that, you know, we have the capacity through this Hydro-Quebec project to make a very significant difference in getting clean, reliable, more affordable energy forward. And it's going to be good as well, again, in some of the discussions that we've been having over the past couple of days, for Maine. My understanding is that the carbon emissions due to the project are going to be reduced by nearly 265 metric tons, and it will also have a very important impact on the price of that Maine ratepayers are going to pay, and will also provide protection against spikes in prices that come from the natural gas volatility in pricing in natural gas. So there are, you know, these projects are never easy, and we know as a country more than, well, as well as you do, that large energy infrastructure is a complicated community issue that has to be worked out at the community level. And my understanding is that that's exactly what's happening with all sorts of important input that will be solicited and provided to find a way to move forward, hopefully, I would say, on this project in a way that makes sense for Mainers and it makes sense for our environment and provides an opportunity for us to try and move forward together. And maybe the other thing I'd like to say, because I think this is a really, really positive story, a very sad story that has turned quite positive, is the cooperative work that we're doing on protecting the North Atlantic right whale. So this species, tragically, has been is in the category of most endangered in both of our countries. And in both Canada and the U.S., have been taking very concerted efforts over the past year and a half to really get our heads around what we have to do to protect this species. 2017 was a terrible year for the right whale, and the fatalities were devastating. However, 2018, due to the sense of, I think, commitment and cooperation that was achieved through focusing our minds on this crisis, measures were put in place. They led to an incredible improvement, such that in fact there were zero reported fatalities in Canadian waters for this species, which is remarkable. And we're now moving towards implementing our 2019 processes or regulations to further improve the measures that we've put in place. And here, you know, To be honest, the danger to the whales are coming from strikes and entanglements in the fishery sector. And so finding the right kind of solution requires also respecting and working with the sector so that we don't save the species but then take the livelihood away from many important people in our communities. And so it's complicated, and finding out how to do it is complicated. But one of the things that's been so wonderful in the discussions I've had and what I've learned about us working together on this project is that focusing our minds clearly and effectively and quickly has made a dramatic difference right away, and we're continuing to move forward to make it even better. And yes, it's not perfect for the fishers, but in fact there are mitigation measures that have also been put in place that I think are going to be working well for them too. So I just like to say that is a really positive. I mean, there's, in addition to the charging stations for the cars, there's also the whales. These are very good stories, and I'm delighted to have learned a lot about them. So now I know it's getting hot, and I've been talking a long time. So I'd like to just close to talk. We talked about history, geography, trade, the environment, and I'd like to close with a few comments on our security and defense partnership. Since moving to DC, one of the greatest privileges that I've had is we have at our embassy close to 50 Canadian defense staff stationed in Washington. And we have thousands of Canadian defense staff stationed all over the United States working in joint operations here in the U.S. and patrolling the borders, both sea and air and land, with your troops. This is not a community that I had really known very much in my earlier parts of my career, but meeting the men and women, both Canadian and American, who are working together, who are regularly coming to brief us on what they're doing and the successes that they are having, protecting our border, protecting our waterways. Now, so it's not just our defense staff, but also our Homeland Security equivalent, our FBI, our RCMP, the literally hundreds of joint operations that they have going every single day, and the successes that they have, which they cannot talk about, which you will not read about in the paper, but I've had the privilege to learn about many of them. I can talk about some of them, but it is a remarkable, and it is a very awe-inspiring, and somewhat, it makes me feel safer and securer, to be very honest with you, having gotten to know these individuals and what they're doing. So our border, we talked about how much goods cross our border every day. We have 400,000 people crossing the Canada-US border every day. 400,000 people. So making that border efficient for commerce is really important, but making it safe for our citizens is equally important. And the degree to which there is joint information sharing, cooperation, infrastructure work, not only at ports of entry, but across the border, on the maritime borders, is remarkable. I'm going to give you a couple of examples, even though I said we're not allowed to talk about examples too much, but these ones have been in the press. So we had, just last month, based on a tip from the FBI, we had some arrests in Kingston, Ontario, because of individuals who are being tracked as national security threats to both of our countries. And these people move around, right? And there was a joint operation, a joint intelligence gathering operation, a joint Canadian investigation with the FBI, and four people were arrested based on intelligence sharing and cooperation. We also have something called the Shipriders Program, where Canada and U.S. patrol vessels carry both Canadian and U.S. law enforcement, and they are in the Great Lakes, and they, you know, depending on who they pick up, one of them has to go to work or the other, depending on who or what side of the lake they're on, which is terrific, right? I mean, it's fantastic. The other thing that we do hear an awful lot about, and I am personally find this very moving, is both off of the Pacific coast and in the Northern Indian Ocean, Canadian and U.S. military work together to seize illegal narcotics. So these are illegal narcotics that are either destined for sale within our boundaries, or in the case of the North Indian Ocean, they're largely used to be sold in Asia, and the proceeds of which are used to fund terrorism. And we have seized, in these joint operations, literally billions of dollars worth of illegal narcotics in the past year and a bit. And it's because of all of these areas of cooperation. So on that, I would just like to close and say, we are most definitely your closest neighbor, your closest partner, your best trading partner, and your best ally. And if I may, one more time, because we are such a good ally, it becomes even more incomprehensible for us to have our citizens and our economies battered based on tariffs that have been imposed for national security purposes. If the unreasonable of that isn't obvious, well, then I haven't done my job tonight. So I would like to close and get to questions, because I am a bit of a blab. I would like to close and get to questions, but before I do, I would just like to say once again, it has been a true delight to spend the last 2 days in Maine. My only regret is that I wasn't here with my family. My husband, who is from Halifax, would have been very happy to have been here. Actually, he was born in New Brunswick, but his family's in Halifax. But maybe next time. He's busy, he's got to work. So I started with the story of the bell, a bell that symbolizes our friendship, enduring friendship. I think that this trip and the opportunity I've had to meet so many wonderful people has done nothing but reinforce that friendship for me. We have difficult issues. We have difficult economic issues. We have difficult environmental issues to face. I am more convinced than ever, though, that working together to face them, we will succeed, and we will all benefit from that. So thank you, and I look forward to a discussion.
This is Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Maine's Honorary Consul of Canada, Brenda Gerrand, will now lead a question and answer session with the audience.
Thank you so much, Ambassador Holman. It's been a pleasure having you. As is our tradition, we'd like to take a limited number of questions, so please speak up and we'll be glad to hear what you have to say.
Increasingly, all trade is global. So I wanted to ask, is the opening of the Northwest Passage a factor at all in your work?
Ah, okay. Do I answer each question or take a few first?
Yes.
Okay. So in my work here in the U.S., not that much. But obviously the opening of the Northwest Passage is a very critical issue for Canada in relation to a few things, commerce, the environment, our indigenous populations up north, but also sovereignty, right? And we do work together very well within the Arctic Council with other Arctic nations, and I think that we're confident that, you know, we'll be able to move through those discussions in a way that makes sense for our countries. I should say defense too, actually. I didn't mention defense, but I think defense is a very important issue in all of that as well. So my personal responsibilities here in the U.S., it is not a major component, but it is a very important topic of discussion in Canada for sure.
Thank you for being here, Ambassador. It's more of a comment than a question, but having served in the Air Force for 33 years, a great deal of my career was with working with Canadian officers. And I want to say what a privilege and an honor it was to work with our Canadian allies and how you really are our best ally. So I appreciate that, and I do appreciate your comment, too, about whether we can impose tariffs for national security reasons, which strikes me as very odd.
Thank you. May I take the opportunity, based on that comment, to offer very quickly another fact, anecdote fact. So on 9/11, when the airplanes went into the Twin Towers, there's an organization called NORAD, which I'm sure you know well, which is the Joint Canada-US Patrol of our airspace. And it's a joint command. So at the time of 9/11, the command was under a Canadian, it was under Canadian command. And so, in fact, it was a Canadian commander who called the order for closing down the Canada-US airspace, who called the call to arms, I guess, I don't know if I get my terminology right, but who made the declaration. And it was indeed that Canadian who then decided when it was safe to reopen the airspace. I think that's also a very, very good example about how we are one community, right? We are one defense community, we are one security community, we are one brother and sisterhood in protecting our homeland together. But thank you very much for the comment.
Ambassador Hillman, thank you, and there's so much I'd like to talk to you about, having started a company in Canada 28 years ago to save jobs here in Maine, and it all went well, and the devil's in the details, but there are things that go both ways. Mm-hmm. The whole tariff discussion is really about reciprocity. One of the things that's kept our company from growing is the tax law in Canada that charges us double corporate tax for me being a non-resident. Mm. So it is always about the details. Yep. And so I hope to have a chance to talk again.
All right. Thank you.
One more question.
I can tell from your speech that you realize that there's been a sort of surge in populism in the United States and other countries as well, right-wing populism with the election of Donald Trump here, with Brexit in the UK, and many other places in Western Europe have seen a surge in populist parties, even in Scandinavia. But Canada seems to be somewhat, if not immune, then at least highly resistant to populist sentiments. And I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about either something that we're not aware of, that there is an issue in Canada, or what your secret is.
Well, I think to answer that question, I would first say I interpret, based on your question, populism to mean a sentiment where people seek to turn inward to their communities and to seek to turn inward to their nation rather than turning outward to their partners and their allies in the world. I'm not sure if that's how you mean it, but for the purpose of my answer, I'm going to use that as the definition. I think that the first thing I would say is I think that the root of those feelings is very legitimate. I think that it comes from a place where people feel insecure and afraid and that things aren't working out for them in the way they'd like to. And those are very powerful, important feelings that need to be recognized and realities that need to be respected. And then the question becomes, what do you do with that, right? And what do you do as a nation? What do you do as a leader? What do you do as a family, as a community about that? Our current prime minister, and Canadians generally, I think it's fair to say, remain very outward looking. Partly it's history, I think, and partly it's the fact that we are incredibly diverse and multicultural. So this is an interesting statistic that I used the other day and surprised many of my colleagues. The city of Toronto, our largest city, over 50% of the people who live in Toronto were not born in Canada. I mean, that's Toronto, okay? I'm from a different part of the country, in rural parts of the country. It's not going to be the same demographics. But we have a very vibrant, open society. And what happens, I think, is that those people that come into the country, they're your neighbors, right? They're your friends, they're in your kid's school, they're your business partners, they're your spouse, and it just, it tends to humanize people coming from outside. But that being said, do Canadians suffer from the same sort of sense of worry or insecurity, or it's not working out the way I'd like to, or my job is no longer here? Of course they do. And then it becomes, what do you do with those feelings? Do you take those feelings and try to address them through public policy, through working together, through finding solutions forward, or through blaming other people or other countries, or saying what we need to do is put up walls and protect ourselves? We don't actually have the option, in my view, of putting up walls and protecting ourselves. One's because I don't think it's part of our national identity, but two, Canada is a big, big country with a low population and a whole lot of resources. And if we want to maintain the standard of living we have to be open to the world, right? We produce so much more than we consume. So if we want to keep a high standard of living for our people, we have to be open to the world. And if we want them to be open to us, we have to be open to them. That's how, in my view.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's speaker was the Chief Trade Negotiator and Deputy Ambassador for Canada, Kirsten Hillman. She recently spoke with the World Affairs Council on Canada's relationship with Maine. If you missed part of the program or want to hear it again, you can always find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to access this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is edited by me, Lucy Suchek. Thanks for joining us.